Good day, good day, good day, you lovely listeners to Stories, Fables, Ghostly Tales. And I'm your host, The Tale Teller. This week's chilling episode of Haunting Stories is one where we'll delve into Ambrose Bierce's eerie tale, The Middle Toe of the Right Foot. You heard me right. Set in an abandoned and reportedly cursed plantation house in the American South, our story begins when a man named William Galbraith challenges another, known only as Manton, to duel to avenge a deep personal grievance. Just like me when someone takes the lunch out of my workroom. Under the cover of darkness, the two adversaries and a witness converge at the desolate Manton house. The rules of the duel are bizarre and unsettling. Instead of pistols, the duel will be fought in utter silence and darkness, a battle more of nerves than of bullets. As the men prepare, the air grows thick with the weight of past tragedies that echo through the dilapidated halls of Manton House. As the night progresses, we explore the haunted past of the house and the mysterious circumstances that led to its abandonment. Witnesses have spoken of inexplicable sounds and sights within its walls, suggesting that the house itself is alive with the spirits of those who met tragic ends there. Then, lights in the mood, with a pivot to H.P. Lovecraft's The Vault, where a hapless undertaker, George Birch, discovers that cutting corners when burying the dead can lead to some uncomfortably slapstick situations. Stationed in the quiet town of Peck Valley, George finds himself in a precarious situation when a minor mishap requires him to re-enter the vault he built with his questionable carpentry skills and his series of darkly humorous missteps. George's night in the graveyard turns into a comedy of terrors. From the haunted and harrowing depths of Manton House to the laughably grim antics in the Peck Valley graveyard, prepare yourself for an episode that oscillates between the terrifying and the absurd. Join me as we explore how sometimes in the world of horror, the line between screaming and laughing can be as thin as a coffin lid. Enjoy. The Middle Toe of the Right Foot by Ambrose Bierce. Chapter 1. It is well known that the old Manton House is haunted. In all the rural district nearby, and even in the town of Marshall, a mile away, not one person of unbiased mind entertains a doubt of it. Incredulity is confined to those opinionated persons who will be called cranks as soon as the useful word shall have penetrated the intellectual demesne of the Marshall Advance. The evidence that the house is haunted is of two kinds. The testimony of disinterested witnesses who have had ocular proof, and that of the house itself. The former may be disregarded and ruled out on any of the various grounds of objection, which may be urged against it by the ingenious, but facts within the observation of all are material and controlling. In the first place, the Manton House has been unoccupied by mortals for more than 10 years, and with its outbuildings is slowly falling into decay. A circumstance which in itself the judicious will hardly venture to ignore. It stands a little way off the loneliest reach of the Marshall and Harriston Road, in an opening which was once a farm and is still disfigured with strips of rotting fence and half covered with brambles overrunning a stony and sterile soil, long unacquainted with the plough. The house itself is in tolerably good condition, though badly weather-stained, and in dire need of attention from the glazier. The small male population of the region having attested, in the manner of its kind, its disapproval of dwelling without dwellers. It is 2 stories in height, nearly square, its front pierced by a single doorway, flanked on each side by a window boarded up to the very top. Corresponding windows above, not protected, serve to admit light and rain to the rooms of the upper floor. Grass and weeds grow pretty rankly all about, and a few shade trees somewhat the worse for wind, and leaning all in one direction seem to be making a concentrated effort to run away. In short, as the Marshall Town humorous explained in the columns of the Advance, the proposition that the Manton House is badly haunted is the only logical conclusion from the premises. The fact that in this dwelling Mr. Manton thought it expedient one night some 10 years ago to rise and cut the throats of his wife and 2 small children, removing at once to another part of the country, has no doubt done its share in directing public attention to the fitness of the place for supernatural phenomena. To this house, one summer evening, came 4 men in a wagon. 3 of them promptly alighted, and the one who had been driving hitched the team to the only remaining post of what had been a fence. The 4th remained seated in the wagon. "Come," said one of his companions, approaching him while the others moved away in the direction of the dwelling. "This is the place." The man addressed did not move.
"By God,"
he said harshly, "this is a trick, and it looks to me as if you were in it."
"Perhaps I am,"
the other said, looking him straight in the face and speaking in a tone which had something of contempt in it. "You will remember, however, that the choice of place was with your own assent left to the other side. Of course, if you are afraid of spooks..."
"I am afraid of nothing," the man interrupted with another oath, and sprang to the ground.
The 2 then joined the other at the door, which one of them had already opened with some difficulty, caused by rust of lock and hinge. All entered. Inside it was dark, but the man who had unlocked the door produced a candle and matches and made a light. He then unlocked a door on the right as they stood in the passage. This gave them entrance to a large square room that the candle but dimly lighted. The floor had a thick carpeting of dust, which partly muffled their footfalls. Cobwebs were in the angles of the walls and depended from the ceiling like strips of rotting lace, making undulatory movements in the disturbed air. The room had 2 windows in adjoining sides, but from neither could anything be seen except the rough inner surfaces of boards a few inches from the glass. There was no fireplace, no furniture. There was nothing besides the cobwebs and the dust. The 4 men were the only object there which were not part of the structure. Strange enough, they looked in the yellow light of the candle. The one who had so reluctantly alighted was especially spectacular. He might have been called sensational. He was of middle age, heavily built, deep-chested and broad-shouldered. Looking at his figure, one would have said that he had a giant strength, at his features, that he would use it like a giant. He was clean-shaven, his hair rather closely cropped and grey. His low forehead was seamed with wrinkles above the eyes, and over the nose these became vertical. The heavy black brows followed the same law, saved from meeting only by an upward turn at what would otherwise have been the point of contact. Deeply sunken beneath these glowed in the obscure light a pair of eyes of uncertain colour, but obviously enough too small. There was something forbidding in their expression, which was not bettered by the cruel mouth and wide jaw. The nose was well enough, as noses go. One does not expect much of noses. All that was sinister in the man's face seemed accentuated by an unnatural pallor. He appeared altogether bloodless. The appearance of the other men was sufficiently commonplace. They were such persons as one meets and forgets that he met. All were younger than the man described, between whom and the eldest of the others, who stood apart, there was apparently no kindly feeling. They avoided looking at each other.
"Gentlemen," said the man holding the candle and keys,
"I believe everything is right. Are you ready, Mr. Rosser?" The man standing apart from the group bowed and smiled.
"And you, Mr. Grossmith?"
The heavy man bowed
and scowled. You will be pleased to remove your outer clothing. Their hats, coats, waistcoats, and neckwear were soon removed and thrown outside the door, in the passage. The man with the candle now nodded, and the fourth man, who had urged Grossman to leave the wagon, produced from the pocket of his overcoat two long, murderous-looking bowie knives, which he drew now from their leather scabbards. They are exactly alike, he said, presenting one to each of the two principals. For by this time, the dullest observer would have understood the nature of this meeting. It was to be a duel to the death. Each combatant took a knife, examined it critically near the candle, and tested the strength of the blade and handle across his lifted knee. Their persons were then searched in turn, each by the second of the other. If it is agreeable to you, Mr. Grossman, said the man holding the light, you will place yourself in that corner. He indicated the angle of the room farthest from the door, whither Grossman retired. His second parting from him was a grasp of the hand which had nothing of cordiality in it. In the angle nearest the door, Mr. Rosser stationed himself, and after a whispered consultation, his second left him, joining the other near the door. At that moment, the candle was suddenly extinguished, leaving all in profound darkness. This may have been done by a draught from the opened door. Whatever the cause, the effect was startling. Gentlemen, said a voice which sounded strangely unfamiliar in the altered condition affecting the relations of the senses. Gentlemen, you will not move until you hear the closing of the outer door. A sound of trampling ensued, then the closing of the inner door, and finally the outer one closed with a concussion which shook the entire building. A few minutes afterward, a belated farmer's boy met a light wagon, which was being driven furiously towards the town of Marshall. He declared that behind the two figures on the front seat stood a third, with its hands upon the bowed shoulders of the others, who appeared to struggle vainly to free themselves from its grasp. This figure, unlike the others, was clad in white, and had undoubtedly boarded the wagon as it paused the haunted house. As the lad could boast a considerable former experience with the supernatural, thereabouts his word had the weight justly due to the testimony of an expert. The story, in connection with the next day's events, eventually appeared in the Advance, with some slight literary embellishments and a concluding intimation that the gentleman referred to would be allowed the use of the paper's columns for their version of the night's adventure. But the privilege remained without a claimant. Chapter 2. The events that led up to this duel in the dark were simple enough. One evening, three young men of the town of Marshall were sitting in a quiet corner of the porch of the village hotel, smoking and discussing such matters as three educated young men of a southern village would naturally find interesting. Their names were King, Sancha, and Rosser. At a little distance, within easy hearing, but taking no part in the conversation, sat a fourth. He was a stranger to the others. They merely knew that on his arrival by the stagecoach that afternoon, he had written in the hotel register the name Robert Grossmith. He had not been observed to speak to anyone except the hotel clerk. He seemed, indeed, singularly fond of his own company, or as the personnel of the Advance expressed it, grossly addicted to evil associations. But then it should be said in justice to the stranger that the personnel was himself of a too convivial disposition, failing to judge one differently gifted, and had, moreover, experienced a slight rebuff in an effort at an interview. I hate any kind of deformity in a woman, said King, whether natural or acquired. I have a theory that any physical defect has its correlative mental and moral defect. I infer then, said Rosser gravely, that a lady lacking the moral advantage of a nose would find the struggle to become Mrs. King an arduous enterprise. Of course you might put it that way, was the reply. But seriously, I once threw over a most charming girl on learning quite accidentally that she had suffered amputation of a toe. My conduct was brutal, if you like, but if I had married that girl, I should have been miserable for life and should have made her so.
Whereas, said Sancho with a light laugh, by marrying a gentleman of more liberal views, she escaped with a parted throat. Ah, you know to whom I refer, yes. She married Manton, but I don't know about his liberality. Not sure, but he cut her throat because he discovered that she lacked that excellent thing in a woman, the middle toe of the right foot.
Look at that chap,
said Rosser in a low voice, his eyes fixed upon the stranger. That chap was obviously listening intently to the conversation.
Damn his impudence,
muttered King.
What ought we do?
That's an easy one, Rosser replied, rising.
Sir,
he continued, addressing the stranger,
I think it would be better if you would remove your chair to the other end of the veranda. The presence of gentlemen is evidently an unfamiliar situation to you.
The man sprang to his feet and strode forward with clenched hands, his face white with rage. All were now standing. Sancho stepped between the belligerents.
You are hasty and unjust, he said to Rosser. This gentleman has done nothing to deserve such language.
But Rosser would not withdraw a word. By the custom of the country and the time, there could be but one outcome to this quarrel.
I demand the satisfaction due to a gentleman, said the stranger, who had become more calm.
I have not an acquaintance in this region. Perhaps you, sir, bowing to Sancho,
will be kind enough to represent me in this matter.
Sancho accepted the trust, somewhat reluctantly, it must be confessed, for the man's appearance and manner were not at all to his liking. King, who during the colloquy had hurriedly removed his eyes from the stranger's face and had not spoken a word, consented with a nod to act for Rosser, and the upshot of it was that, the principals having retired, a meeting was arranged for the next evening. The nature of the arrangements has been already disclosed. The duel with knives in a dark room was once a commoner feature of southwestern life than it is likely to be again. How thin a veneering of chivalry covered the essential brutality of the code under which such encounters were possible. We shall see.
Chapter 3.
In the blaze of a midsummer noonday, the old Manton house was hardly true to its traditions. It was of the earth, earthy. The sunshine caressed it warmly and affectionately, with evident disregard of its bad reputation, the grass greening all the expanse in the front, and seemed to grow not rankly, but with a natural and joyous exuberance, and the weeds blossomed quite like plants, full of charming lights and shadows and populous with pleasant-voiced birds. The neglected shade trees no longer struggled to run away, but bent reverently beneath their burdens of sun and song. Even in the glassless upper windows was an expression of peace and contentment due to the light within. Over the stony fields, the visible heat danced with a lively tremor, incompatible with the gravity, which is an attribute of the supernatural. Such was the aspect under which the place presented itself to Sheriff Adams and two other men who had come out for Marshall to look at it. One of these men was Mr. King, the sheriff's deputy. The other, whose name was Brewer, was a brother of the late Mrs. Manton. Under a beneficent law of the state, relating to property which has been for a certain period abandoned by an owner whose residence cannot be ascertained, the sheriff was legal custodian of Manton Farm and appurtenances thereunto belonging. His present visit was in mere perfunctory compliance with some order of a court in which Mr. Brewer had an action to get possession of the property as heir to his deceased sister. By a mere coincidence,
The visit was made on the day after the night that Deputy King had unlocked the house for another and very different purpose. His presence now was not of his own choosing. He had been ordered to accompany his superior, and at the moment could think of nothing more prudent than simulated alacrity in obedience to the command. Carelessly opening the front door, which to his surprise was not locked, the sheriff was amazed to see, lying on the floor of the passage into which it opened, a confused heap of men's apparel. Examination showed it to consist of two hats and the same number of coats, waistcoats, and scarves, all in a remarkably good state of preservation, albeit somewhat defiled by the dust in which they lay. Mr. Brewer was equally astonished, but Mr. King's emotion is not of record. With a new and lively interest in his own actions, the sheriff now unlatched and pushed open a door on the right, and the three entered. The room was apparently vacant. No. As their eyes became accustomed to the dimmer light, something was visible in the farthest angle of the wall. It was a human figure. That of a man crouching close in the corner. Something in the attitude made the intruders halt when they had barely passed the threshold. The figure more and more clearly defined itself. The man was upon one knee, his back in the angle of the wall, his shoulders elevated to the level of his ears, his hands before his face, palms outwards, the fingers spread and crooked like claws, the white face turned upward on the retracted neck, and had an expression of unutterable fright. The mouth half open, the eyes incredibly expanded. He was stone dead, yet with the exception of a bowie knife, which had evidently fallen from his own hand, not another object was in the room. In thick dust that covered the floor were some confused footprints near the door, and along the wall through which it opened, along one of the adjoining walls, too, past the boarded-up windows, was the trail made by the man himself in reaching his corner. Instinctively in approaching the body, the three men followed that trail. The sheriff grasped one of the outthrown arms. It was as rigid as iron, and the application of a gentle force rocked the entire body without altering the relation of its parts. Brewer, pale with excitement, gazed intently into the distorted face.
"God have mercy!"
he suddenly cried. "It is Manton!"
"You are right," said King, with an evident attempt at calmness. "I knew Manton. He then wore a full beard and his hair long, but this is he."
He might have added,
"I recognized him when he challenged Rossa. I told Rossa, and Sancho, who was before we played him this horrible trick. When Rossa left this dark room at our heels, forgetting his outer clothing in the excitement and driving away with us in his shirt sleeves, all through the discreditable proceedings, we knew whom we were dealing with, murderer and coward that he was."
But nothing of this did Mr. King say. With his better light, he was trying to penetrate the mystery of the man's death, that he had not once moved from the corner where he had been stationed, that his posture was that of neither attack nor defense, that he had dropped his weapon, that he had obviously perished of sheer horror of something that he saw. These were circumstances which Mr. King's disturbed intelligence could not rightly comprehend. Groping in intellectual darkness for a clue to his maze of doubt, his gaze directed mechanically downward in the way of one who ponders momentous matters, and fell upon something which, there in the light of day and in the presence of living companions, affected him with terror. In the dust of years that lay thick upon the floor, leading from the door by which they had entered, straight across the room to within a yard at Manton's crouching corpse, were three parallel lines of footprints. Light but definite impressions of bare feet, the outer ones those of small children, the inner a woman's. From the point at which they ended, they did not return. They pointed all one way. Brewer, who had observed them at the same point, was leaning forward in an attitude of rapt attention, horribly pale.
"Look at that!"
he cried, pointing with both hands at the nearest print of the woman's right foot, where she had apparently stopped and stood.
The middle toe is missing. It was Gertrude.
Gertrude was the late Mrs. Manton, sister to Mr. Brewer. Written by Ambrose Bierce, 1842, and released in 19 unknown. There is nothing more absurd, as I view it, than that conventional association of the homely and the wholesome which seems to pervade the psychology of the multitude. Mention a bucolic Yankee setting, a bungling and thick-fibred village undertaker, and a careless mishap in a tomb, and no average reader could be brought to expect more than a hearty, albeit grotesque, phase of comedy. God knows, though, that the prosy tale with which George Birch's death permits me to tell has in its aspects beside with which some of our darkest tragedies are light. Birch acquired a limitation and changed his business in 1881, yet never discussed the case when he could avoid it. Neither did his old physician, Dr. Davies, who died years ago. It was generally stated that the affliction and shock were results of an unlucky slip whereby Birch had locked himself for 9 hours in the receiving tomb of Peck Valley Cemetery, escaping only by crude and disastrous mechanical means. But while this much was undoubtedly true, there were other and blacker things which the man used to whisper to me in his drunken delirium toward the last. He confided in me because I was his doctor, and probably because he felt the need of confiding in someone else after Davis died. He was a bachelor, wholly without relatives. Birch, before 1881, had been the village undertaker of Peck Valley, and was a very calloused and primitive specimen, even as such specimens go. The practices I heard attributed to him would be unbelievable today, at least in a city. And even Peck Valley would have shuddered a bit had it known the easy ethics of its mortuary assistant in such debatable matters as the ownership of costly laying-out apparel invisible beneath a casket's lid, and the degree of dignity to be maintained in posing and adapting the unseen members of lifeless tenants to containers not always calculated with sublimest accuracy. Most distinctly, Birch was lax, insensitive, and professionally undesirable, yet I still think he was not an evil man. He was merely crass of fibre and function, thoughtless, careless, and licorice, as his easily avoidable accidents proves, and without that modicum of imagination which holds the average citizen within certain limits fixed by taste. Just where to begin Birch's story, I can hardly decide, since I am no practice teller of tales. I suppose one should start in the cold December of 1880, when the ground froze and the cemetery delvers found they could dig no more graves till spring. Fortunately, the village was small and the death rate low, so that it was possible to give all of Birch's inanimate charges a temporary haven in the single antiquated receiving tomb. The undertaker grew doubly lethargic in the bitter weather, and seemed to outdo even himself in carelessness. Never did he knock together flimsier and unganglier caskets, or disregard more flagrantly the needs of the rusty lock on the tomb door, which he slammed open and shut with such nonchalant abandon. At last the spring thaw came, and graves were laboriously prepared for the 9 silent harvests of the grim reaper which waited in the tomb. Birch, though dreading the bother of removal and interment, began his task of transference one disagreeable April morning, but ceased before noon because of a heavy rain that seemed to irritate his horse, after having laid but one mortal tenement to its permanent rest. That was Darius Peck, the nonagenarian whose grave was not far from the tomb. Birch decided that he would begin the next day with little old Matthew Fenner, whose grave was also nearby, but actually postponed the matter for 3 days, not getting to work till Good Friday the 15th. Being without superstition, he did not heed the day at all, though ever afterwards he refused to do anything of importance on that fateful 6th day of the week. Certainly, the event of that evening greatly changed George Birch. On the afternoon of Friday, April the 15th, then Birch set out for the tomb with horse and wagon to transfer the body of Matthew Fenner. That he was not perfectly sober, he subsequently admitted, though he had not then taken to the wholesale drinking by which he later tried to forget certain things. He was just dizzy and careless enough to annoy his sensitive horse, which as he drew it viciously up at the tomb neighed and pawed and tossed its head, much as on that former occasion when the rain had vexed it. The day was clear, but a high wind had sprung up, and Birch was glad to get to the shelter as he unlocked the iron door and entered the side heel vault. Another might not have relished the damp, odorous chamber with the 8 carelessly placed coffins, but Birch in those days was insensitive, and was concerned only in getting the right coffin for the right grave. He had not forgotten the criticism aroused when Hannah Bixby's relatives, wishing to transport her body to the cemetery in the city, whither they had moved, found the casket of Judge Catwell beneath her headstone. The light was dim, but Birch's sight was good, and he did not get Asaph Sawyer's coffin by mistake, although it was very similar. He had indeed made that coffin for Matthew Fenner, but had cast it aside at last as too awkward and flimsy, in a fit of curious sentimentality aroused by recalling how kindly and generous the little old man had been to him during his bankruptcy 5 years before. He gave old Matt the very best his skill could produce, but was thrifty enough to save the rejected specimen and to use it when Asaph Sawyer died of malignant fever. Sawyer was not a lovable man, and many stories were told of his almost inhuman vindictiveness and tenacious memory for wrongs real or fancied. To him, Birch had felt no compunction in assigning the carelessly made coffin, which he now pushed out of the way in his quest for the Fenner casket. It was just as he had recognized old Matt's coffin to that door, slammed to the wind, leaving him in a dusk even deeper than before. The narrow transom emitted only the feeblest of rays, and the overhead ventilation funnel virtually none at all, so that he was reduced to a profane fumbling as he made his halting way among the long boxes towards the latch. In this funeral twilight, he rattled the rusty handles, pushed at the iron panels, and wondered why the massive portal had grown so suddenly recalcitrant. In this twilight, too, he began to realize the truth and to shout loudly as if his horse outside could hear, could do more than neigh an unsympathetic reply. For the long-neglected latch was obviously broken, leaving the careless undertaker trapped in the vault, a victim of his own oversight. The thing must have happened about 3:30 in the afternoon. Birch, being by temperament phlegmatic and practical, did not shout long, but proceeded to grope about for some tools which he recalled seeing in the corner of the tomb. It is doubtful whether he was touched at all by the horror and exquisite weirdness of his position. But the bold fact of imprisonment so far from the daily paths of men was enough to exasperate him thoroughly. His day's work was sadly interrupted, and unless chance presently brought some rambler hither, he might have to remain all night or longer. The pile of tools soon reached, and a hammer and chisel selected. Birch returned over the coffins to the door. The air had begun to be exceedingly unwholesome, but to this detail he paid no attention as he toiled at the heavy and corroded metal of the latch. He would have given much for a lantern or bit of candle, but lacking these, bungled semi-sightlessly as best he might. When he perceived that the lot was hopelessly unyielding, at least to such meagre tools, and under such tenebrous conditions as these, Birch glanced about for other possible points of escape. The vault had been dug from a hillside, so that the narrow ventilation funnel in the top ran through several feet of earth, making this direction utterly useless to consider. Over the door, however, the high, slit-like transom in the brick facade gave promise of possible enlargement to a diligent worker. Hence upon this his eyes long rested as he racked his brains for means to reach it. There was nothing like a ladder in the tomb, and the coffin niches of the sides and rear, which Birch seldom took the trouble to use, afforded no ascent to the space above the door. Only the coffins themselves remained as potential stepping stones, and as he considered these, he speculated on the best mode of arranging them. 3 coffin heights, he reckoned, would permit him to reach the transom, but He could do better with four. The boxes were fairly even and they could be piled up like blocks, so he began to compute how he might mostly stably use the eight to rear a scalable platform four deep. As he planned, he could not but wish that the unit of his contemplated staircase had been more securely made. Whether he had imagination enough to wish they were empty is strongly to be doubted. Finally, he decided to lay a base of three parallel with the wall, to place upon this two layer of two, and upon these a single box to serve as the platform. The arrangement could be ascended with a minimum of awkwardness and would furnish the desired height. Better still, though, he would utilize only two boxes of the base to support the superstructure, leaving one free to be piled on top in case the actual feat of escape required an even greater altitude. And so the prisoner toiled in the twilight, heaving the unresponsive remnants of mortality with little ceremony as his miniature towel of babble rose course by course. Several of the coffins began to split under the stress of handling, and he planned to save the stoutly built casket of little Matthew Fenner for the top, in order that his feet might have as certain a surface as possible. In the semi-gloom, he trusted mostly to touch to select the right one, and indeed came upon it almost by accident, since it tumbled into his hands as if through some odd volition after he had unwittingly placed it beside another on the third layer. The tower at length finished, and his aching arms rested by a pause during which he sat on the bottom step of his grim device. Birch cautiously ascended with his tools and stood abreast of the narrow transom. The borders of the space were entirely of brick, and there seemed little doubt but that he could shortly chisel away enough to allow his body to pass. As his hammer blows began to fall, the horse outside whinnied in a tone which may have been encouraging and may have been mocking. In either case, it would have been appropriate, for the unexpected tenacity of the easy-looking brickwork was surely a sardonic commentary on the vanity of mortal hopes, and the source of a task whose performance deserved every possible stimulus. Dusk fell and found Birch still toiling. He worked largely by feeling now, since newly gathered clouds hid the moon, and through progress, and though progress was still slow, he felt heartened at the extent of his encroachments on the top and bottom of the aperture. He could, he was sure, get out by midnight, though it is characteristic of him that this thought was untinged with eerie implications. Undisturbed by oppressive reflections on the time, the place, and the company beneath his feet, he philosophically chipped away the stony brickwork, cursing when a fragment hit him in the face, and laughing when one struck the increasingly excited horse that pawed near the cypress tree. In time, the hole grew so large that he ventured to try his body in it now and then, shifting about so that the coffins beneath him rocked and creaked. He would not, he found, have to pile another on his platform to make the proper height, for the hole was on exactly the right level to use as soon as its size might permit. It must have been midnight at least when Birch decided he could get through the transom. Tired and perspiring despite many rests, he descended to the floor and sat a while on the bottom box, to gather strength for the final wriggle and leap to the ground outside. The hungry horse was neighing repeatedly and almost uncannily, and he vaguely wished it would stop. He was curiously unelated over his impending escape and almost dreaded the exertion, for his form had the indolent stoutness of early middle age. As he remounted the splitting coffins, he felt his weight very poignantly, especially when, upon reaching the topmost one, he heard that aggravated crackle which bespeaks the wholesale rending of wood. He had, it seems, planned in vain when choosing the stoutest coffin for the platform, for no sooner was his full bulk again upon it than the rotting lid gave way, jouncing him 2 feet down on a surface which even he did not care to imagine. Maddened by the sound or by the stench which burrowed forth even to the open air, the waiting horse gave a scream that was too frantic for an A and plunged madly off through the night, the wagon rattling crazily behind it. Birch, in his ghastly situation, was now too low for an easy scramble out of the enlarged transom, but gathered his energies for a determined try. Clutching the edges of the aperture, he sought to pull himself up, when he noticed a queer retardation in the form of an apparent drag on both his ankles. In another moment, he knew fear for the first time that night. For, struggle as he would, he could not shake clear of the unknown grasp which held his feet in relentless captivity. Horrible pains, as of savage wounds, shot through his calves, and in his mind was a vortex of fright mixed with an unquenchable materialism that suggested splinters, loose nails, or some other attribute of a breaking wooden box. Perhaps he screamed. At any rate, he kicked and squirmed frantically and automatically whilst his consciousness was almost eclipsed in a half-swoon. Instinct guided him in his wriggle through the transom and in the crawl which followed his jarring thud on the damp ground. He could not walk, it appeared, and the emerging moon must have witnessed a horrible sight as he dragged his bleeding ankles toward the sanitary lodge, his fingers clawing the black mold in brainless haste, and his body responding with that maddening slowness from which one suffers when chased by the phantoms of nightmare. There was evidently, however, no pursuer, for he was alone and alive when Armington, the lodgekeeper, answered his feeble clawing at the door. Armington helped Birch to the outside of a spare bed and sent his little son, Edwin, for Dr. Davis. The afflicted man was fully conscious, but would say nothing of any consequence, merely muttering such things as, "Oh, my ankles! Let go!" or "Shut in the tomb!" Then the doctor came with his medicine case and asked crisp questions and removed the patient's outer clothing, shoes and socks. The wounds for both ankles were frightfully lacerated about the Achilles tendon, seemed to puzzle the old physician greatly, and finally almost to frighten him. His questioning grew more than medically tense, and his hands shook as he dressed the mangled members, binding them as if he wished to get the wounds out of sight as quickly as possible. For an impersonal doctor, Davy's ominous and awestruck cross-examination became very strange indeed, as he sought to drain from the weakened undertaker every least detail of his horrible experience. He was oddly anxious to know if Birch were sure, absolutely sure, of the identity at the top coffin of the pile, how he had chosen it, how he had been certain of it as the Fenner coffin in the dusk, and how he had distinguished it from the inferior duplicate coffin of vicious Asaph Sawyer. Would the firm Fenner casket have caved in so readily? Davis, an old-time village practitioner, had of course seen both at their respective funerals, as indeed he had attended both Fenner and Sawyer in their last illnesses. He had even wondered at Sawyer's funeral how the vindictive farmer had managed to lie straight in a box so closely akin to that of the diminutive Fenner. After a full 2 hours, Dr. Davis left, urging Birch to insist at all times that his wound be caused entirely by loose nails and splintering wood. What else, he added, could ever, in any case, be proved or believed. But it would be well to say as little as could be said, and to let no other doctor treat the words. Birch heeded this advice all the rest of his life till he told me this story. And when I saw the scars, ancient and whitened as they then were, I agreed that he was wise in so doing. He always remained lame, for the great tendons had been severed. But I think the greatest lameness was his soul. His thinking processes, once so phlegmatic and logical, had become ineffaceably scarred. And it was pitiful to note his response to certain chance allusions, such as Friday, tomb, coffin, and words of less obvious concatenation. His frightened horse had gone home, but his frightened wit never quite did. He changed his business, but something always preyed upon him. It may have been just fear, and it may have been fear mixed with a queer, belated sort of remorse for bygone crudities. His drinking, of course, only aggravated what it was meant to elevate. When Dr. Davis left Birch that night, he had taken a lantern and gone to the old receiving tomb. The moon was shining on the scattered brick fragments and marred facade, and the latch on the great door yielded readily to a touch from the outside. Steeled by ordeals in dissecting rooms, the doctor entered and looked about, stifling the nausea of mind and body that everything inside also smelled, and the smell induced. He cried aloud once, and a little later gave a gasp that was more terrible than a cry. Then he fled back to the lodge and broke all the rules of his calling by rousing and shaking his patient and hurling at him a succession of shuddering whispers that seared into the bejeweled ears like the hissing of vitriol. "It was Asaph's coffin, Birch, just as I thought. I knew his teeth, with the front ones missing on the upper jaw. Never, for God's sake, shoo those wounds. The body was pretty badly gone, but if I ever saw vindictiveness of any face, or former face, you know what a fiend he was for revenge. How he ruined old Raymond 30 years after their boundary suit, and how he stepped on the puppy that snapped at him a year ago, last August. He was the devil incarnate, Birch, and I believe his eye for an eye fury could beat old Father Death himself. God, what a rage. I'd hate to have it aimed at me. Why did you do it, Birch? He was a scoundrel, and I don't blame you for giving him a cast-aside coffin, but you always did go too damned far. Well, enough to skimp on the thing some way, but you knew what a little man old Fenner was. I'll never get that picture out of my head as long as I live. You kicked hard, for Asaph's coffin was on the floor. His head was broken in, and everything was tumbled out. I've seen sights before, but there was one thing too much here. An eye for an eye? Great heavens, Birch. But you've got what you deserved. The skull turned my stomach, but the other was worse. Those ankles cut nearly off to fit Matt Fenner's cast-aside coffin. Oh. And so ends The Vault by H.P. Lovecraft. And that wraps up our episode. From the chilling echoes of Manton House to the darkly comedic corners of Peck Valley's graveyard, I hope you found tonight's tales both thrilling and weirdly amusing. A special thank you to all of you who tune in each week to explore the shadowy realms of horror and creepy strangeness with me. I also want to extend a heartfelt thank you to you legends, my supporters and Patreons. Your enthusiasm and generosity keeps these stories alive and my spirits high. If you enjoyed today's episode, consider joining our community of Patreon for exclusively early episodes and super high quality audio at 320 kilobytes per second, opposed to the 192. And you get the episodes 5 days sooner. I don't run ads and never will, so any support and love you send my way is greatly appreciated. And lastly, if you get a chance, leave a review via iTunes. I got a very, very lovely, lovely iTunes review which says, "Stories, fables, and amazing storytellers. I've listened to almost every episode in just over a year. That's a feat. And no other podcast compares. That's very sweet. First of all, the stories, creepypastas, urban legends, and OTRs are incredible, but the Telltale is what really got me into the channel to start. Oh my goodness, you flatter me. The Telltale has a great voice and vibe personality that is positive and very enjoyable, to put it simply. He even incorporates his followers' stories from time to time, and I have a story I'll be sending in hopes to hear in the podcast myself. So as I've heard many times, until next we meet." Well, Nick Legendary Wilson 3503, thank you so much for being so sweet and posting that iTunes review. My goodness, I'm going to have to keep my head from swelling up and floating to the roof in my house, because that is such a sweet review. Thank you again, mate. So if you get a chance, leave an iTunes review. It makes the world a difference. And I appreciate every single one of you. Now, I want to say a huge thank you to my Patreon supporters, of which you can reach and see by visiting www.patreon.com/sfgt.com. Now, without further ado, hold on to your hats, because there's going to be a tornado of thanks, of which is about to touch down. And at the helm of this gratitude twister is the amazing Old Night Tea Titan, Matto Star, my pal and my legendary friend. Known far and wide as the Grand Poobah of Tea Leaves, this Old Night Tea Titan, an all-around champion of support and charity, Matto, you do more than just help out. You are this podcast's financial GPS, an old wizard guiding me through the murky waters of budgeting. I recently got in touch with my podcast and web hosting, and I queried on the expenses and had a bit of a look around, managed to surprisingly garner a 30% discount just by simply asking, what am I actually getting with my web hosting? Don't worry, this is not an ad. I'm just explaining how much I saved. But thanks to you, Matto Star, and patrons like you, I'm able to cover those sort of overheads.
Your support, mate, is a lighthouse that keeps our storytelling ship from crashing against the rocks, ensuring our audio escapades sparkle, and my tea is ripe and always fresh. Like a seasoned traveler's passport, your spirit, mate, shines brighter than a supernova on a moonless night. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Matto Star, for your phenomenal support. You're not just unforgettable. You're the gold standard of epic sagas and legendary friendships. I've got your lovely email, buddy, and rest assured you'll be hearing from me this coming weekend. I guarantee it. Thank you for your patience, and I can't wait to sink my teeth into that email and respond. Thank you, mate, for being my friend. And on to my whitey warlords, first of which is the Titan of Triceps, the Destroyer of Dull, the Bench Press of Bionicle Strength, Leza, the Bicep Blaster. Leza, you're like a superhero whose superpower is splashing color all over the drab canvas of the everyday. You lift our spirits higher than your impressive deadlifts. And let me tell you, your support is the secret sauce in our success sandwich. You don't just set the bar, you throw it out of the park. So hats off to you, Leza. You crank the awesome dial past 10 and break the knob off. Brilliant Lazuka Rex, thanks for being my friend. Thanks for supporting me, always and always. You're brilliant. And I hope you know it, mate. And now, bouncing into the spotlight with the energy of a double espresso, give it up for Joseph Schroeder, the Sorcerer Supreme of the White Tea Warlord Realm and the patron saint of this podcast journey. Joseph, your support hits us like lightning, shocking or inspiring, and totally revitalizing. You're the spark that turns our mumbled musings into booming broadcasts, the magic dust that makes every episode sparkle. Huge thank you for being our guiding star and for that burst of sunshine you toss our way every week and every month with your support. Your legendary generosity will be sung by podcast bards for generations to come, and teacups will clink in kind. Thank you, mate, for your support, Joseph, and for being my pal. Lovely to have your support, as always. And now I want to thank the kangaroos that bounce up and down, my Earl Grey enforcers, fearless defenders, against the terrible forces of boredom. I'm blessed to have such a formidable band of rapscallion tea warriors. I've got Chad Warren, Just Heather, Sunshine Days, Juicebox Andy, Peter Raffaele, Divided by Zero, Paige Kramer, Jane Gumnick, Michael Krupp, Jandy Prince, and Seductive Smiles. A huge shout out to my Patreon powerhouses, the Earl Grey Enforcers. You guys and gals are also my MVPs. More vintage than vinyl, cooler than a cucumber and a hipster's grin. Thank you for sticking with me on my wacky audio adventures. Raise your glass to yourselves, you fabulous mythical beasts, you. Now, I hope your week is fantastic and that you're drinking so much tea, you're more tea than man or woman. But all in all, I'll catch you next Monday. But for now,